This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Label Clothing Company. They have been a huge supporter of mine for many years now. And anytime you see me wearing a dress shirt or a suit, it is from them. Everything is custom made. And anyone who knows me knows I hate wearing suits and I hate wearing dress shirts. I not only look dapper, but the clothes feel great and wear really well. So anyone in the need of a custom suit, definitely hit them up. You can find them online at label.co. What is up, everybody? Anthony Vasquez here, joined by my guest today, David Miller, one of the founders of the Label clothing brand. David and I dig deep onto entrepreneurship, how he left his job to pursue his dream of owning his own business, and the pitfalls and the turbulence and the hard times that they embarked on. And more importantly, how he and his brother, yes, his brother, he is in a part of what we would call a family business because they are in it together, how they manage that relationship, how family dinners have definitely changed a bit. And most importantly, they've become super successful, but what it took to get there, I think, is even better. The other thing David really pointed out is that as an entrepreneur, you can't just be locked in on a certain path. You have to have the ability to pivot and change with the marketplace, and also to have the really 360 vision to not just see directly what's in front of us, but sometimes the road may veer one way or the other. And when we're able to make those pivots, we can capture a different marketplace. And before you know it, our brand has evolved like theirs has to not just a really amazing clothing brand, but a huge portion of their business is doing alterations. And if David and his brother did not have the foresight and the ability to pivot when that opportunity presented to themselves, things would be probably very different for themselves. So David was truly open. He's someone I respect greatly as an entrepreneur. He gave up his very good job in investment banking to pursue his dreams. And as you know, anyone who goes for it, I am totally down with. So without further ado, I bring you my friend and also my client, David Miller. What is up, everybody? Today, I am joined by my friend, my client, and co-founder of Label.co, as well as alteration specialist, David Miller. Really excited to have him on. You know, we're trying to bring guests that are not just wedding-centric, but people who are entrepreneurs. And as soon as we started the show, David was one of the people on my list to bring on because I think you bring a vast wealth of knowledge. And I'm really excited for him to share his wisdom with you, especially for the fact that they broke into one of the most competitive markets, the custom men's clothing market in New York City, probably the most competitive market in the world for this type of business. So I think he brings a vast wealth of knowledge. And without further ado, I bring you my friend and guest, David Miller.
Well, thanks, Anthony, for the introduction. I appreciate, you know, being here, and I'm happy to answer any questions and share my wealth of knowledge, as you put it.
If you could just give us a drop a little bit about your business and your background.
Sure. So we started Label about 6 years ago. I co-founded the company with my younger brother, Jeremy, and we both were looking to partner up to start a company and to revamp what we thought was an industry that lacked a dominant market player. And we wanted to infuse custom clothing with a premier brand. So our goal was to start a company that resonated with a large group of people and, you know, bring exceptional value at a wide variety of price points and also just products.
So how does that even begin? You guys are like sitting down drinking beers one day and go, fuck it, we're going to like dig in here and start a custom clothing business in New York City?
Like, so the short story is that at the time I was working investment banking at Barclays. Okay. Jeremy was doing medical research at NYU, and we were just catching up. We were having dinner at a local Chinese restaurant, and we were just both, you know, talking about our careers, our goals, and we came up with this idea to partner up together. And the way we thought about it was that at the time I was getting my shirts made by a local tailor, and I actually had become good friends with the guy. I became actually one of his really good clients, and we really, you know, developed a good friendship, and I learned a lot about the industry through him. So it always was in the back of my mind that one day if I did something entrepreneurial, that maybe I would enter that industry because I loved the consumer experience, picking out clothing. And it just seemed something that would be a good idea because, again, like that industry lacked a go-to company for its products. It is a very saturated market, but there's no dominant company that people think of when they're thinking about custom clothing. People get it from their, people are getting custom suit shirts and jackets from a local tailor. Everyone, quote unquote, has his or her company. So we thought that if we could develop a company that would become a strong brand in the marketplace, that it would be a good business opportunity for us. So we want to take everything that he was doing well and do it a little bit better. We actually almost partnered up with the tailor that I was using. He was a really good guy, still a really good guy. And it didn't work out. He actually helped us get started. So, you know, we're extremely appreciative of everything he did for us.
Well, so, okay, right. So we're at a Chinese restaurant and this conversation happens. For people out there who have an idea, right, and I know, I think in today's social economy, everyone has ideas, right? There's a huge difference between having an idea and a concept and then going from concept to implementation, right? What was that initial, like, oh, okay, we're going to A, quit our jobs, which are nice security, 401ks, good salaries, yeah. You have an apartment in New York City, potentially risk all that to start a custom clothing business. I'm sure there must have been some people who were like, man, they were at the Chinese restaurant where they were eating Chinese food and not hallucinogenics. Like, yeah. What were those first steps like and what was the mindset like when you...
Sure. So from my standpoint, I had developed a little bit of savings from working in banking. People that know me very well would actually describe me as being a risk-averse person. So when people hear this story, they're usually surprised. There was definitely a little bit of skepticism from close friends and family. They're like, Dave, are you really giving up an investment banking job to go start a company from scratch with your brother? You guys have no background in this industry. You don't know anything about the industry. I think our mindset was, is if we worked hard enough, we would persevere and we would be successful. So failure for us wasn't an option. I know that sounds very cliche, but we really believe that if we put in the work and the effort that we would ultimately be successful. It was a very challenging, first couple of years for us, getting everything started from the branding to setting up the operations to getting employees to even just coming up with a business plan. We pivoted multiple times during the first couple of years, what type of clients we were going after, whether we were going to have more of a traveling model, whether we were going to have a physical brick and mortar operation. But getting back to our initial conversations, that Jeremy and I were having at the time, we weren't so focused on that, the probability of failing, truthfully. We just kept saying like, we're going to do X, Y, and Z. If that doesn't work, we're going to pivot to doing something else. We just had in our mindset that we would do whatever was necessary to be successful. In the back of my mind, I said, if this didn't work out, I would, do something else in finance or go to business school. But I would caution anyone that, before quitting a secure job, that you need to make sure that you have the capital to not get a paycheck for a year, 2 years, 3 years, because there's no guarantee that you'll be successful. And on top of it, you have to expect not to get paid for a while. In fact, you need money to invest in your business.
It's the opposite.
Yeah, exactly. So I would say that we were fortunate in the sense that I had some capital that I could deploy to get the business started.
Okay.
Without that, I'm not sure we would have been able to do what we did. And to this date, we're completely self-financed. We've never taken investor capital. We've been approached by a number of companies to take investments, but it's never made sense for us. And we always want to keep the autonomy that we have to make decisions that we want to make to grow the business the way we want to grow. Yeah,
I think there's like this romantic, over romanticized notion of taking on capital for people that don't understand. And I think that's due in large part to Shark Tank. There's this fantasy of like, oh, I'm going to partner with a private equity and they're going to take 30% or in some cases controlling portion of my business. Well, now you just became an employee. of that person.
For sure.
And you know, what people don't understand is a lot of the time there could be multiple rounds of financing. So you just gave away 30% on your initial round. You're going to have to go back to them for money. And they know that. And they know the next time they're going to hit you for another 30%, in which case now they control your organization.
Yeah, absolutely. And so that's one of the considerations, is like dilution of your ownership stake in the company, and also the direction and control that you want to go in. Sometimes investors have a different view on how you should grow your business. In fact, sometimes co-founders get kicked out of the company when they lose enough ownership. But I would say the biggest thing is that taking outside capital can really misalign. Well, it can result in misaligned objectives. Mm-hmm. We've seen companies in our space take on outside capital, and what we've seen is that they start becoming extremely focused on growing top line sales.
Yep.
In fact, they start, you know, quote unquote, buying customers by, you know, spending a lot of money on advertising, and they will do things that are not necessarily in the best interest of the company, but their sole goal is growing top line sales so they can get to the next round of financing. And for us, we've tried to take steps to grow sales, you know, grow our profitability, and also do what's in the best interest of our company, our staff, our clients. So I feel like it provides a more balanced approach by, you know, doing your own thing. However, I do recognize at some point it does make sense maybe to raise capital.
Yeah.
But I think that some companies raise capital too quickly. A lot of companies will raise capital right out of the gate. And you have to be mindful of all the risk and considerations.
Yeah, now you're not just accountable to your employees, you're accountable to investors, and that money is usually not lent for free.
For sure.
It's growing, you know, and it's like, it's, you know, in some cases, I feel like I know people who've raised money, and the money raising was the death of the company before it even started, because now the investors were controlling.
Yeah, and also just from a compensation perspective, investors will limit how much income and that the founders are able to make over, you know, the longevity of the company.
Yes.
So unless you have a big liquidity event at the end, like, you're really putting a lot of your future income at the hands of the investors, who are going to dictate the terms of when you can have an exit, how much money you will make. So there's a lot of risk involved. And I think a lot of entrepreneurs underestimate those risks when they first get started.
Yeah. So something that just comes to mind, right, as you guys are sitting down at this Chinese restaurant contemplating your future lives, walking away from probably nice jobs, right, is how does one even begin to start a manufacturing business? Because ultimately, I know you guys sell high-end clothes, but you know, you guys were not in the fashion business, didn't grow up, you know, in the fashion world, right? So now it's like, okay, we see there's a hole in the market. We can exploit that and capitalize on this. And we know we can do it. We're going to be successful, right? Okay, it's Monday at 9 a.m. You both quit your jobs. You decided on label.co. Who's making this stuff? Like, where do you even... just fill me in. I'm so curious. Like I know when I started, my business was simple. I wanted to be a wedding photographer. Okay. Back in 2001, open up a studio. People would walk into the studio. You start taking pictures. Very linear. It was like, okay, I knew people in the business. I grew up in the wedding business. I had already been doing it for 7 years. It wasn't like I had to start thinking about all these things. You guys didn't necessarily have that. So how did you, A, go about getting that knowledge? And then B, where do you even start, really, is the question.
So I became really good friends with the tailor that was making my shirts and suits. And he played an instrumental role in getting us started. And, you know, we're forever grateful for everything that he did to help us get started. He actually introduced us to his suppliers. So we started working with his suppliers. I already had, you know, some knowledge and familiarity with them just through my own experiences working with him. I knew what things, you know, worked well, what things didn't work so well. So that really helped us get started. However, we decided very early on to switch suppliers and to do, to, you know, find the best options for every single thing that we were trying to make. What we learned is that there was really not one supplier that fulfilled all of our needs in the marketplace. So if we were selling an entry suit, we needed one supplier. If we were selling more of a mid-tier suit, we needed another. And if we were selling like the highest end type of suit, we needed another supplier. And also when it came to fabric options, we wanted a wider range of options. So that was actually one of the challenges that we faced, was how do we get in front of these top tier manufacturers, and how do we get top tier fabric providers to take us seriously? When you're talking to the Zegnas and Laura Pianos of the world, when you're a small player, they're not going to talk to you.
Just to give people a premise, small player as in the amount of fabric you're buying, linear fabric.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So the way the custom clothing business works is that, you know, everything is made to order. So when someone comes in, they want a suit, you then go back to the fabric supplier and you say, hey, I need X number of yards to make a suit. So if you're a company that's just starting and you can only say to Laura Piana or Zegna, hey, like, I don't know what the demand's going to be, but I maybe can get like a couple yards of your fabric a year. They don't want to do business with you.
Sure.
So it took us some time to develop these relationships. And what ended up happening was we actually were introduced to a company called Dorme very early on. Dorme is also a very high-end fabric mill. And they were eager to actually gain our business. And so we started doing a lot of work with them. And then as we got bigger and bigger, we then got approached by Zegna and Laura Piana. They had their reps reach out to us.
Isn't that amazing?
And we were really, you know, that was a very satisfying moment for us, because when we initially reached out to them, our emails, our phone calls didn't get returned. So it took a long time and a lot of mistakes made to get to the right place. We tested out a lot of different manufacturers. We kept asking people in the industry, hey, who are the top people to make suits? And we made, again, a ton of errors, but we finally found our way. And we're still to this day always trying to seek the best value for our customers. And at this point, we have multiple different manufacturers, and that allows us to really provide a great value to our customers, whether you're getting, you know, our entry suit that's predominantly machine made, or you're getting a semi-handmade garment, or you're getting a fully handmade garment. All those suits are manufactured by different suppliers.
Damn. I love when people blow you off in life and then come back around. Shit's so satisfying. I've had it in my business.
Yeah.
When those phone calls come in, I just go, yeah.
Especially in an industry like this where there are really only a handful of high-end manufacturers.
No, I think people don't necessarily know, like Laura Piana, they see the brand name, but they don't realize that fabric could wear many different labels, because people
exactly
buy a wholesaler from Laura Piana.
Yes. So there are
Zegna for you.
Yeah. So Zegna and Laura Piana are the two, I would say, household names that are also two of the biggest luxury fabric manufacturers in the world.
Which is probably the bigger portion of their business is on the wholesale side, I would assume.
Yeah, right? That's actually huge parts of their business. And a lot of people, they hear of Laura Piana and Zegna and they think of the Fifth Avenue, Madison Avenue,
yes,
brick and mortar stores in Beverly Hills and Manhattan, et cetera. But a lot of the other high-end clothing companies will use either Laura Piana, Zegna, or an alternative, a company similar to those to manufacture, as the fabric for their suits. So when you're getting a suit from, you know, a really high-end store called Gucci, Prada, et cetera, they don't manufacture their own fabric.
Of course.
So they're buying the fabric from a Zegna, Laura Piana, or a Dorme, et cetera. So it was really hard for us to develop those relationships, but once we got them, it proved very, effective, and it was really important for us to have those relationships as we, you know, grew our business. When you're getting customers in the door who want very expensive suits, people that were previously buying from Brioni, Keaton, etc., they're expecting the top end fabrics, and if you don't have that, you can't service those customers.
Which I always find interesting too is that most people don't realize that, you know, to have a Brioni suit, right, let's say, you can probably procure a lot of that same fabric from a private distributor like yourself, and you don't need to go to necessarily Brioni, where you're paying the extremely elevated price of brick and mortar rent.
For sure.
All those things that get factored into it, whereas you can go to Label and be like, hey, I want this Brioni fabric, and most of the times I'm guessing you guys can procure that fabric.
For sure. And that also goes back to the fact that for a suit, there's really two main components. It's the fabric quality and it's also the construction. So you'll have a lot of tailors and other custom clothing companies that will say, hey, we can make a custom suit with Lore Piana Super 120 for, you know, $1,200. However, I would ask the question, what type of, you know, handwork's involved and what is the quality of that manufacturing? With a Brioni suit, you know you're getting top-end fabric quality and also a very high-end make. Mm. And the make of the suit is really important. It, it dictates and determines how well the suit's going to perform over time. Like, does if the suit's going to mold to your body, how wearable is it, the durability aspect of it. So with a Brioni suit, you're getting all that. So I would caution anyone when they're thinking about a custom suit to ask about, you know, what is the quality of the manufacturing? What type of canvas does it have? How is it going to wear over time? And also things such as, does the suit have functional buttonholes? Things about, you know, the stitching. So there's a, those are the two main components.
If a custom suit is $300, it's $300 for a reason.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's,
no,
that's the truth, though.
We will sometimes get, potential customers in the door who say, I see another tailor offering a Lore Piana custom suit for $550. And then our answer is, well, if you can get a legitimate Lore Piana suit for that price point, then you should go for that.
Yeah.
Because I could tell you right now that buying the fabric wholesale, I know that genuine, like authentic Lore Piana fabric is going to be more
than what you're paying cost on that suit.
Exactly.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. One of the unfortunate things about this industry is that there's a lot of pirate and, you know, fake fabric floating around the world. You know, and that really dilutes, in some ways, the products that a lot of companies are selling. Everything that we are producing is all authentic. In fact, a lot of the fabrics that we sell have serial numbers baked into it. Mm. So, you know, you really get what you pay for. And I would say that the real Lore Piana, the real Lasagna, the Dormes of the world, that fabric wears really well and you're going to have it for a long time. So, you know, you might think you're winning if you're paying $500 for that Lore Piana suit. However, how's it going to wear over the next 2 years?
Yeah. And I think, I mean, it's interesting. I think there's, I always said, what's expensive is cheap and cheap is expensive, you know?
Yeah.
And if you're going to buy and invest in something that is going to have longevity, you know,
sure.
Like anything else in the world. So to get back to like you guys, so you started this, Taylor hooks you up, business is rolling. I'm sure the first few years of business were arduous, I'm going to guess, especially in a competitive place like this. There had to be moments in time where you were like, what did we do? Why are we here? Right. This is, you know, the infancy of the business. Would you guys like come together? Not only are you business partners, but your brother. I'm sure there were some interesting family dinners at some point.
Yes. It's working with a brother provides a lot of challenges. There's no question about it. The family dynamics are interesting to say the least.
Yeah.
I can say that even though it's just my brother and myself, it really is a family business.
Uh-huh.
in the sense that whenever there is some type of disagreement, everyone in our family is alerted to that disagreement.
I'm sure.
We will get a phone call from our father, one of us will, a few hours later, and he'll say, David, I heard you and Jeremy are disagreeing about, you know, opening up your next location and where it should be. And I'll be like, how did you know about that? It's like, I heard from your sister.
It's a family business.
Yeah. So it's definitely challenging. However, I think we would both agree, and I emphasize, I think we both agree that the pros far outweigh the cons.
Yep.
Because, you know, there's implicit trust and accountability that you wouldn't necessarily get if you were working with, you know, a random person or even a close friend. And, you know, we always know that at the end of the day that we can trust each other. And I think that's a huge part of it. You know, there's definitely been moments where we both have been stressed out. We've been overwhelmed. I think that we've always, again, just had that mentality that failure is not an option and we're going to do whatever we need to do to persevere. And we've faced a ton of challenges. You know, there's been so many things that haven't gone our way. And, you know, there's also been a lot of things that have gone our way. And, you know, we've really celebrated those moments. You know, for instance, you know, Jeremy was named to Forbes 30 Under 30, yes. And it was really it was validation of, you know, what we've done, and you know, that was a really, you know, great moment for us.
So what were some of those challenges? Because you said you faced a bunch, and then ultimately this validation, Forbes 30 Under 30. I think I always say, aside from the social recognition, the greatest validation to any business is a profitable balance sheet.
For sure.
Because you can have all, you know, I feel like, especially in today, I say this all the time, in today's social economy, everyone's an entrepreneur. Everyone's living their best life right now. It's all bullshit. I know so many people, if you look at their Instagram page, you'd think they were gazillionaires. They're operating in the red. They have tax issues. You know, I know somebody who people think is... He's also top 50 most delinquent New York State taxpayer. Like, so, you know, he owes the government a ton of money. Buddy, that's not profitable. Yeah. You know, so I say profitability is always the best payback. But from dumping money into the business to now becoming profitable, what were some of those big challenges that you and your brother faced, other than obviously the simple challenge of having Laura Piano allow you to procure fabric from them, which is massive?
So just getting the right employees on board was extraordinarily challenging, especially in the custom clothing space. We found it really difficult to get the right type of people working for us and to get really talented people to want to work for us and also to stay. When you're a brand new company entering a space, you know, people are naturally a little bit hesitant, and we found that super challenging to get talented people to join the company. Once we started getting people to join and, you know, to then be successful, it became a lot easier to recruit and retain. But that was a huge challenge for us. Another challenge was even just getting like trademark protection for label. When we first started, we filed for trademark protection and we got denied. We used a law firm, and then
let's preface, law firm in New York City at how much an hour?
Yeah.
So people understand like the
a $600 per hour type law firm, which apparently these days is actually like not that expensive. Some lawyers,
which is insane.
Well, yeah, insane. Yeah.
I just want preface of startup capital needed. Like when you're running at a $600 tab, like people think like it is, the money's going out. It's not coming back this way yet. Like the investment is, it's flowing the wrong way.
There's a lot of expenses. We were referred to someone who was an expert in this field. And, you know, we were advised very early on, you got to get your company brand trademarked very quickly. We got denied. I then, with Jeremy, we disputed that finding. You're able to file a subsequent report to challenge the first, verdict that they
rendered. Still at $600 an hour.
Oh, no, we did. So we did it on our own. So once that lawyer came back, once we found out that we got denied, we had filed an appeal on our own. We're not lawyers. We Googled a lot of different things, and we actually filed again on our own with no lawyer, and we got on the secondary registry for trademark protection. So
imagine if you would have just stopped at the lawyer, you know, and I think that that's like the beauty in entrepreneurialism is you guys could have just been like, all right, maybe that could have been a pivoting moment. Right
yeah,
there,
for sure.
Like, screw it. Yeah. Maybe we can't, we don't have a viable business.
Yeah. I mean, so for us, we're the type of people that just don't take no for an answer. No. And, you know, some people might say we're stubborn, but, in a case like that, it proved to be, you know, helpful for us because we were able to secure something without having to spend additional money and capital to do it with a professional firm. Also, I would say that even just figuring out the right type of real estate infrastructure you need to grow your business is very challenging. How much square footage you need, what type of leases should you be taking on? Should they be short term? Should they be long term?
And that in and of itself is something that, like, I remember when we moved into New York City 9 years ago, and my landlord was like, oh, I'll give you a 9-year lease. I was like, oh my God, that's so long. Except that was at the low of the commercial real estate market. Should have signed a 30-year lease because we're never going to see $20 a square foot again in Manhattan, newsflash to the world. But that was coming right out of the recession of 08 and 09, and commercial real estate was beyond low at that point. But you don't have the foresight in that moment. You're like, I'm taking a huge risk signing 9 years. Meanwhile, I should have signed for the for life at that point. You know, even at 3% increments, I'm still still less. And it's always interesting because as a business owner and entrepreneur, you're literally faced with daily decisions, and each one of those decisions could impact the rest of your life. Like what we just talked about before you came in, 2010, I should have bought a condo office space because it was so cheap back then. Looking back now, 9 years, go, oh shit, you know, I would have had that almost paid off if I did a 15-year note, and I'd be in my space 6 years from now for free, paying less than what rent is.
Yeah.
You know,
so for us, like as we were talking about before, you know, we started the show, we're in the process of right now trying to buy a loft for Label because we think that now is a great time to invest in real estate given the market right now. Rates are very low and, you know, real estate in the city is depressed. So we feel like it's a great opportunity for us. And, but it's a huge decision and it will tie up a lot of capital, but we think that it makes the most sense. And, you know, we'd rather, you know, put money towards something that we'll own as opposed to, you know, keep paying exorbitant rent prices on Madison Avenue.
But I mean, the thing is, you know, for you guys, from a long-term play, 30 years, when you extrapolate that out, you guys are looking back on this now at 65 years old with a 2,000 square foot loft in New York City that could be worth 10x what it is now instead of paying rent to a landlord.
For sure.
And that's one of the, I feel like one of those pivotal decisions where now your grandkids could potentially be set up from an investment play your company made. You know, and again, like, it's those little major big decisions, but you could go one way or another way and those become life altering decisions.
Yeah, it's a huge decision and it's not one that we've taken lightly. We've been talking about it for a little bit over a year. We gave notice to our current landlord that we're going to be out. So I think we have like another 7 or 8 months to lock something down. We've been looking at a bunch of different properties, but as to your point, it's a huge decision and it will have life altering implications for us.
But yeah, positively, right? You cash flow wise, you tie up again, people, you know, capital king, cash is king. When you tie up a lot of that cash in real estate, it becomes illiquid.
For sure.
And now that money is committed to.
Yeah. So we've run through the numbers and, you know, done all sorts of analysis and we think it makes sense. And, we got to go with our gut here. I mean, there's to make it, you gotta take some risks.
Yeah.
And
you guys are making calculated risks.
Where, oh, for sure.
Like, some people just, I feel like, we had a company in this building, fab.com. I don't know if you ever heard of them. Very quickly. they were in this suite, actually, that we're in right now. And when I came in the building 9 years ago, they had 8 employees. They took the first 2 floors in this building. Within 2 months, they left, screwed over the landlord here, went to 3 floors, I believe, in Union Square, filed 6 months later for bankruptcy and screwed over all their investors.
Oh my God.
It was poor decision. You know, I don't think anyone did a careful analysis of the fact that they didn't have a profitable business and they just signed a massive lease. You know, they got money. It sounded sexy, the whole thing. But you guys are taking risk, but there's obviously a level of intelligence and financial analysis. Yeah, blindly doing
stuff. Yeah, for instance, so for our alteration business, alteration specialist, we started with one office in Union Square just to, you know, test proof of concept. And then we grew that into 2 offices. They were adjacent to each other. And that model was successful for us. And we knew very quickly that this was a successful business model. And since that time, we now we have 4 locations in Manhattan and we're adding our 5th in the next couple of months on the Upper West Side. And we have grown at a steady pace. And to your point, we're always calculating whether the next move makes sense for us. We're looking at the finances because we're not funded by an investment company and we're using all of our own capital, we have to operate like that.
Yes.
I can't just tomorrow open up 12 locations and just hope it works out. I need to make sure that it's a calculated risk and it's a risk that makes sense for us.
Yeah. I mean, and it makes total sense. You have to, I mean, every day, because every dollar, people look at it and you got to look at it at a micro level. Every dollar counts. Sure. There's no wasted money, especially, you know, and once you open up that funnel, money can start going out faster than it's coming in.
We've been very disciplined as far as investing our capital. And Attestment's that point is that we were cash flow positive about a year into the business. So we've been able to do that because we've been very frugal with our capital, and we're willing to take risks, but it's a very calculated risk. And to give you an example, when we started doing, Google marketing, you have to deploy a certain amount of capital, and they usually are looking for very long-term commitments. And instead, we started off with, hey, we're going to do a little bit right out of the gate. Let's test it for a couple of months, and then we're able to see if this makes sense for us. And then if it makes sense, we put in more capital. But some entrepreneurs will just say, hey, we're going to put in hundreds of thousands of dollars right out of the gate, and then it doesn't work for them, and they blow through their capital.
Well, they have no, and they haven't test-proofed their concept yet either. Like, yeah, people just want to get to the end game, and then they haven't actually made sure that there's, number one, a marketplace that's viable for the idea that they have. And then I think the other thing too is, and I have a good friend who ran into this problem, is they raised money but didn't raise enough money, and
lights went out
like that, and it happened quick, you know. And and I was like, man, and they undercapitalized themselves massively because they didn't realize what they were going to burn through in the first year of business just to keep the lights on. And it was a brick and mortar, and it just was a massive undertaking.
Yeah, I mean, that's another great point. I mean, you definitely need to keep ample reserves to meet your payroll needs, to pay your rent, to pay your lights, etc.
Yeah, nobody cares. Like, if nobody buys a suit from you tomorrow, your employees still have to get paid.
Exactly. And we've done a really good job with that, making sure that we kept enough financial resources that even if we had, you know, a number of slow months that people were getting paid and our vendors were getting paid, etc., we've never operated in a way that would put us at risk. So we're always making sure that, you know, whether we're buying a loft or we're taking on a new investment opportunity, that we're always keeping ample reserves.
So as you guys, you brought up something really interesting. As you guys evolved Label evolved itself, it sounds like, and you saw another opportunity, which was the alterations business, which sounds like it's grown into a massive part of your company at this point. And I think, personally, sometimes people become so locked in on, like, okay, imagine if you guys would have said, we're only going to be a clothing manufacturer. Well, you just left a huge portion of your revenue stream on the table at some point. So you obviously saw a moment, you pivoted. How did you guys even contemplate starting an alterations business? To point out, you're on your journey, you're entrepreneurs, you're committed, you've built this brand. You could have easily ignored this massive opportunity, but you guys didn't. Why?
So I would say two things. When we first started, we recognized very early on that we needed a solution for our own alterations. Mm. Clothing was coming in, and, you know, clients would want slight tweaks, which is very natural for, especially on a first order. You know, people would want maybe the sleeve length to be adjusted slightly or the pant length to be adjusted slightly. So we were using a bunch of, we tested out a bunch of different tailoring options in the city, and we realized very quickly that alterations in Manhattan were extremely expensive. Not only was price an issue, but the quality / consistency was a major issue as well. We noticed that you could get 10 things altered and you never knew how those 10 things were going to be altered. So you could get 10 pant lengths done or shortenings done, and then they could come back uneven, et cetera. So we realized very quickly that we needed to figure out a better solution for ourselves. So we ended up working with a few local tailors to do our own alterations on like a corporate account basis. And then we became very friendly with one of the tailors. So we actually started the business just to support our own alteration needs. It was then my brother, / co-founder, who really convinced me to turn this into a bigger business. It's a very challenging business, I have to say.
It's very customer service heavy.
Yes. And a lot of things can go wrong. It's a high volume business too. So in a given day, you know, we can have 40, 50 customers at one location. Sometimes even more, especially during, you know, peak season.
And you're committed to potentially handling expensive fabrics.
Yes. People are trusting us with $10,000 plus bridal dresses. We also do corporate alterations for a lot of high-end retailers and fashion brands across the city. So what a lot of people don't realize is that a lot of times when you're going into a high-end bridal store or boutique,
they're actually outsourcing.
And they say they're taking care of the alterations. We're the ones doing the alterations on the back end. So it's a very challenging business. And at multiple points, we definitely contemplated whether it made sense to stick it out in that business. I especially, more so than my brother, was a little bit, I was definitely more pessimistic about that business. But my brother definitely convinced me to, stick it out. And it's definitely grown into be a very successful business. And I'm glad that we decided to remain in that industry. And, we've created a very strong brand. We have a lot of customers who, that are happy with the quality and the service that we're bringing. And I feel like we have differentiated ourselves in that space. We're providing top quality tailoring, also with a really elevated experience. We have a very modern website. Our locations are very trendy. We serve bottled water. And then just the overall experience is just enhanced compared to what you would find at a local tailor or dry cleaner. And on top of that, we alter, pretty much everything, whether it's big, small, complex, simple, we can alter anything. People trust us with their most valuable pieces. We work with a wide range of clientele, and the pieces that we alter are pieces that most tailors can't alter. So I think that's a really big value proposition that we offer.
And what's like the biggest hurdle you and your brother are faced with on a daily basis, other than getting along as brothers and co-entrepreneurs? But no. And also just like, what is the, like, so the business is profitable. You guys are operating, in the black, which is amazing. You're the still own 100% of the company. So you control the destiny without any, anyone else telling you guys what to do, but you now have employees, a lot of them. You've scaled the business, right? But you have to keep the quality consistent. What are some of those kind of look like on a daily? What fires is David putting out on a daily basis?
So I would say that we both are constantly dealing with employee issues that you alluded to.
Employees are never problematic. I can't imagine.
Especially so for our alteration business, we have 30 plus tailors, and that brings issues on a regular basis. People, it could be something as simple as a tailor coming to you and saying, "Hey, I need to get health insurance for my kids," and then we have to then figure out how do we do that. I mean, we don't have a dedicated HR department. We have certain employees that handle HR related matters, but at the end of the day, you have to just figure out how to get it done. So that might involve having to call someone at Oxford and then them referring you to someone at ADP and then just getting it figured out. And then what plans do you offer them? Maybe the plans that you have in place are too expensive. So then you have to figure out alternative solutions. It also could be stuff as, it could be like setting up 401k plans, someone being like, "Hey, I know I've been working here for 3 years, but I want to now get into, I now want to sign up for your 401k benefits." So you now need to figure out how do you get that person enrolled in 401k. So it's a lot of administrative stuff that you don't foresee when you first start. It's also just dealing with just compensation packages. It's kind of ironic because, since we're in the custom space, we have custom like compensation packages for most of our employees. And that gets really challenging.
Because now everyone's on a different compensation package.
Exactly. So we're always trying to optimize performance. And we realize that everyone responds differently to different incentives. So that's been really challenging for us as well. So onboarding is always unique because we're always contemplating different compensation packages. So I would just say that just handling the issues that come up daily with a personnel is very challenging. But, there's always something new that you weren't expecting that comes up.
I would say when you think you've seen it all, you haven't, you know, yeah, something always comes up.
Exactly. And there's always new regulations that are coming out. So you have to always be mindful of that. Like you have to have the right poster boards and there's just a lot of compliance things.
And there's a lot of poster boards these days.
Yes, a lot.
I have like eight in my office and yes. A wedding photography studio and I have a sexual harassment one, a workplace cleanliness one.
Exactly.
I have like, and I'm like, and they come in and check. And I have like eight poster boards in my kitchen. He's like, you have to have these up. And I'm like, I get it. But he's like, if you're not, you're not in compliance. Or you can't W-2 and 1099 someone and you're not doing this. And you're
yeah.
Like, and all these things. And it's like, I just want to go to work.
Exactly.
And a lot of the time I'm doing tasks that have absolutely nothing to do just in the day-to-day ongoing of running the company, which I don't want to do, but I have to. You know, and I think some people, you know, I think the biggest fault of a lot of entrepreneurs is they, I mean, I think it's important to delegate a lot of that stuff, but sometimes you just need to do it yourself.
For sure. And I think one of the things I would recommend to anyone who wants to run a serious business, you need a really good accountant very early on.
They're amazing, aren't they?
And
good ones.
a good accountant also should advise you on some of these compliance issues. For instance, if you are selling, for instance, a custom clothing product, you need to charge sales tax.
Yes.
How do you set that up? Like our accountant helped us do that.
Sure.
So you need to be compliant with stuff like that. And that's really important.
And realize that as you're collecting that almost 9% in New York State or New York City, that's not operating income.
You know, no, like it goes straight to the state.
Yeah. I mean, because it literally.
It's an operating burden.
It's what it is. It's not. But I know people who take their sales tax and spend it and then they pay quarterly and then you wind up, you know, with this 9% bill hanging over your head and you can't pay it. Now you're defaulting on your sales tax, which the state hates. And now you're being audited. And like all these, no one ever says, hey, when you set up business, by the way, you're going to need to manage sales tax. And I feel like there's a million of those little things across the line as an entrepreneur that you pick up along the way. There's no roadmap. That says, hey, by the way, guys, you're going to have to manage sales tax, you know.
And every time that we've learned of something like this, we're always joking, saying, I wish there was a manual. And what we find out is that if you Google it, you'll find it. But there's nothing that says you should have done it in the first place.
and by the way, the government doesn't care that you didn't know.
No, absolutely
not. Clarity-wise, the IRS never
Yeah, knows. No, the burden is on the entrepreneur to be compliant with every single facet of the business.
Yeah, and not just compliant with all the facets, but I feel like the burden is to grow the business, to make it profitable, to handle employee and company culture. There's so many I always said making money is easy. It's managing people and all the other things that go along with making the money. In this country, you know, everyone wants to complain 2019, all the bullshit that goes along politically. It's hard to make money. Look, we're in the United States of America. We're a capitalist country. This is the easiest country in the world to still make money. That's why businesses from around the world still come here to do business, is because it's the easiest place to run a business still, even with all the regulations and all the things we have to deal with. But that being said, there's this menu of items that we get dished that we don't necessarily have the skills that we develop along the way. What would you say, like, you and your brother, biggest, like, lessons in those skill sets that you've had to develop as other than just dealing with, which we know having a company full of unique individual human beings on a given daily basis?
I would say that managing a diverse group of people is definitely something that you don't learn in a textbook. And it's something that we've had to learn hands-on. And it's been very challenging. I would say that getting back to your question, multitasking is extraordinarily important. Like you could be working on one thing and then the next minute, like a fire drill happens and you need to switch gears and you need to be able to constantly switch back and forth between things. And I would say the most important thing, it's not necessarily a skill, but being able to pivot is extraordinarily important. Like you said earlier, some people get steadfast about a certain idea or a concept and they want to just see that through. And you need to let the market speak for itself. If you're pursuing something and you're not seeing the demand for what you're doing, then maybe it makes sense to switch to another idea or to refine your existing idea. And that's not easy either. If you have a business plan in mind, you spend all this time, this effort trying to see something through, you don't necessarily want to, you know, abandon that idea, but sometimes it makes sense to do so.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the other thing too, is sometimes people fall in love with a product or a concept that the marketplace isn't, maybe not, it's not ready for. Maybe there is no market for it. And then in which case it's a hobby, not a business. And there's a huge distinction between the two. But you can fall so in love with an idea, you don't realize that, hey, the marketplace just doesn't need that specific thing, but maybe it needs something similar to it. You just need to be able to adapt
for sure
and facilitate that. Like if you guys would have fallen in love with X, but the market needs Y, well, then you don't have a business. But if you don't have the vision to pivot, now you have nothing. Whereas you guys have made multiple pivots, it sounds like, across the way to get to where you are right now. And if you didn't make those pivots, probably fair to say you wouldn't be as successful as you are right now.
For sure. And when we started our custom clothing business, we initially planned to be a mass market company. And as you know, we're certainly not that. So,
and I almost, to be mass market in today's economy, is that even with where fashion is?
It would have been.
I would think it would be a nightmare.
Yeah, I don't think we would be around.
Yeah, I mean, like, just to compete, first off, brick and mortars are dying across the country, you know, and I've traveled a good amount across the United States this year, and you see big box retailers just shut, you know, and whether it's Sears, Macy's shutting down.
Walmart, yeah, they're operating under razor thin margins. It's really hard to compete. When you're competing on price, it's really a zero-sum game and a race to the bottom.
I mean, yeah, I see J. Crew having tons of financial problems, you know, and I'm very peripherally outside the fashion market, but just for business purposes, I stay interested in it. And I think what you guys did was brilliant, because if you would have gone mass market, even some of the big and high-end retailers, they're struggling. You know, I mean, I know Gucci's doing well, but there's, for every Gucci, there's ones that are not.
For sure.
And they're having problems. And it then begs the question, 10 years from now, are these global high-end fashion brands even going to be around in this current, in the capacity? Some of them, I think it's fair to say some probably won't, you know, and
yeah,
you'll have your Chanel's and your Gucci's, but you'll have ones who don't make it.
Yeah. I think you're going to see a big shift towards, you know, increasing e-commerce platforms.
Yeah.
And you're seeing it even today. A lot of these companies have these high-end brick and mortar shops, especially our Upper East Side Alteration Specialist location is on 62nd and Madison. And you see all these high-end stores, Hermes and, you know, all these high-end watch stores, et cetera. And they've become marketing expenses for these companies.
Yes. Then I would wonder if those places are actually profitable. I don't think they would necessarily be bottom line profitable.
No, they're just, I think the majority of them are not profitable. But I think that you're going to see, you know, diminishing number of brick and mortar stores.
It's the pop, and you see more pop-up experiences. I mean, like, now there's an app on Instagram where you can rent pop-up space all through New York City on a 1 day to 30 day short-term lease, build a pop-up, see how it goes, product test a brick and mortar store, but you have no commitment. You haven't signed a 10-year lease. There's not those financial implications. And I think it just is a sign of the times changing and where our world is. And I think you guys are really smart in how you said, hey, no, we're going to go something a little bit way more, not a little bit, way more exclusive, way more custom tailored, literally custom tailored, no pun intended.
Yeah.
And I can attest to that because I've gone through the process myself of getting jackets and suits from you guys with John. And I've seen it, and I see that there is a distinct quality difference between buying something that is literally custom tailored to you versus something off the rack that then gets tailored to you as well. And there's an inherent value, and there's inherent fit and all the functionality and all those things, but it just looks better too. But for you guys, it's also differentiated you in the marketplace, which is, I'm sure, you know, something else I hear a lot of is my market's oversaturated. There's a lot of people doing what you do, but you guys stand apart from that.
Yeah, the market is very saturated. When we first started, it was saturated. It's gotten even more saturated. You have a lot of finance people, similar to what I did, who recognize that it's a great opportunity because the custom clothing space, you don't need to sit on inventory. So that eliminates, you know, some of the risk that traditional retailers
face. You don't have to buy 5,000 black mediums.
Exactly. So everything's made to order. Yeah. And that also just allows, you know, us to provide better value to customers because we're not paying for all this unnecessary inventory. And that inventory is baked into the prices you're paying off the rack.
Interesting. Yeah, I never even thought about that aspect where, like, Saks has to buy 5,000. I'm sure maybe even higher quantity.
Yeah, and then one third or one half, it doesn't sell, and then it gets put on markdown, and then that goes to some type of outlet store.
Hence, Saks off the rack. Nordstrom's off the rack, and Nordstrom's for less, all those kind of.
I was actually reading something the other day that a bunch of these outlet stores are becoming more profitable for these companies than their actual stores.
I'll tell you a funny story. I was just at Woodbury Commons, the outlet, mm-hmm. and I haven't been forever. And one of the big brands there wasn't Gucci, but like something like that. It was Memorial Day weekend, and I walk in, and the whole store is 80% off. So I have a manager. I'm like, it's like Black Friday. He goes, well, if we don't mark things down 80%, nobody buys anything. And I said, man, that's a horrible business model. Yeah. And he goes, no, we've put ourselves in such a position that people now expect such drastic sales. They're literally only buying on price. So I walked out with like 8 items, total value of $2,200 for like $175. And the guy was like, I was like, I will never come back here and pay $300 for a sweater I just paid $18 for. He goes, and that's why we won't be in business 5 years from now. We're selling to you literally below the cost of manufacturing and shipping. He's like, we're in the blood.
Red. Yeah, and that's also one of the other issues is that a lot of consumers now expect to pay a significant discount whenever they're buying something. Yeah. These big traditional retailers have in a lot of ways conditioned customers to expect the discounts. Every single holiday, there's some type of big discount. So that's one of the things that we've been very mindful of, and we have made it, we've made it a real effort not to become a discount shop.
And I can attest to that. I mean, we do the same thing, and people always come in and they want like the deal of a lifetime. And I'm like, look, deal of a lifetime is at Walmart, not here.
Yeah.
And I mean that respectfully.
Yeah, absolutely. And it protects your brand, and people, you can't fault a customer for asking, but by maintaining your quality and maintaining your price points, you're maintaining the integrity of your brand.
So yeah. And for us, it's the exact same thing. We procure a high-end product. And if I were to cut down my manufacturing costs and go to a cheaper manufacturer, well, then I'm now cheapening my brand, hence becoming maybe more profitable or just taking on the wrong clients. I want the client who sees the value in what we do.
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's... for us, every time when we're thinking about our brand and what makes sense for the next step for us, we're always thinking about maintaining high quality and maintaining that value proposition that customers can appreciate. Because when you're just competing on price, there's always going to be someone that's going to undercut you.
Yeah. And something else that just comes to mind, and I know you guys have been really smart about this, is strategic partnerships, right? So... We Wore What, Something Navy, Girl With No Job. The influencer field is the most oversaturated field in the world. We get hit up all the time by people who say that they're quote unquote influencers. Mm-hmm. I'm like, influencing your friends of 50 is not is not an actual, I mean, your circle of influence is very, 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 very small.
Yeah, it's impressive. Yeah.
I'm like, hey, thanks for the, really? But more importantly, like we share Claudia Ash, your Girl With No Job, as a mutual client. But you've been very smart in how you guys have partnered your brand. And I think because of that, you've obviously seen a good ROI on those partnerships. At what point did you say, hey, these are influencers or platforms with communities that align their values and their base with our base, and it makes sense now to build a partner brand with them?
So we started the Instagram partnership endeavor probably about a year ago.
Okay.
And I would say it was a lot of trial and error. Again, there's no manual for these things. So we were always trying to figure out what made the most sense as far as do we comp free alterations? Is it a discount, or do we actually pay for their services, et cetera? You know, we get approached by Instagram personalities all the time, and they say, hey, I read about your company. I saw them in Forbes, or I saw them on Something Navy, et cetera. And they say, we can, in exchange for alteration, in exchange for a post, do you want to pay us $10,000?
I love that. It's beautiful. And
our answer is always, we're not interested.
Yeah.
However, if you're interested in doing something else, or you're more flexible about the terms, we can discuss further. So it's really become a specific customized approach for, you know, the influencers that we're working with. You know, we have a team that goes through and, you know, make sure that the Instagram personality is on point with our brand, because like you said, you want to make sure that you're partnering up with companies or brands that are aligned with your own, and that you're targeting similar demographics, and that values are similar and shared. So we definitely just make sure that we're partnering up with the right people that make sense for us.
Cool. And then for people out there who are curious about partnering up, how did you guys end up? Did you look at what their interaction was? How'd you test it out to make sure that what you were doing with them was actually coming back to you? How'd you prove that ROI?
Sure. So within a space, so if you're thinking about like fashion bloggers, we started off with, I think the first blogger that we did work with was Danielle Bernstein. Okay. Or what?
Yep.
So once we proved that that model was successful, basically when she posted for us, you know, we measured the amount of customers that we received because you, through all the advanced analytics that are out there now, you can actually see who's clicking on your website. You can look at all of the data. Sure. So once we saw that, you know, working with a high-end blogger like her made sense for us, we then targeted different bloggers in the space that, you know, were similar to her, even though they all have their own unique personality or characteristics. We said, well, that part of the market makes sense for us. And outside of the Instagram stuff, we've also done partnerships with Equinox, high-end auto. We've partnered with dealerships such as BMW, Aston Martin, Ferrari, in Long Island, New Jersey, Connecticut. We've also done select partnerships with, we've done NetJets, and we also did Wheels Up.
Nice.
So we've done partnerships across a wide range of industries. For us, it's always about, are they targeting a similar demographic as us? And is it a brand that is similar to us, even though it's in a different industry?
Yeah, so we're if you can afford to fly NetJets, yeah, chances are you can afford a, or are wearing custom suits. You're not, you know, flying for $69. If you're spending $5,000 to $10,000 on a 2-hour airplane
ride, sure,
you can then, and in most times you're probably traveling in one of a custom made suit. So yeah, I mean, totally on brand with what you guys are doing.
And then also I would say that the terms have to make sense, right? Ooh. So, you know, we get approached all the time by these random aviation companies that will pitch some crazy idea. They'll say, hey, we recognize we're in a similar industry as you. Does Label want to pay $20,000 to be in our magazine that our customers read?
No.
And obviously that doesn't make sense for us. So we're always mindful again of the terms and, you know, is this going to be something that drives ROI for us? Mm. It may not necessarily be ROI in terms of like a monetary ROI. It could just be in terms of, you know, increasing the brand,
sure,
and increasing the prominence of the brand as, sure, well.
Yeah. So I want to ask you a question I ask all my guests, right? Obviously you guys have had your ups, downs, your growth. You made some big life decisions, right? If the younger David could give a piece of advice to the older David from 10 years ago, if you had one piece of wisdom that you embarked upon that has changed your life or really impacted you in a specific way, what would that be?
Wow, Anthony, you're putting me on the spot right there.
Fuck yeah.
So my dad's going to love this answer if he sees this, but he told me and told all my siblings the same thing. Pursue something that you're passionate about. Mm. And I would say the younger David was more driven by monetary aspects. I wanted to just make as much money as I could. And I initially chose investment banking as an industry because I thought it would prove to be something that would allow me to make a lot of money. And I did do well. And I, you know, I'm grateful for the opportunity. I also learned a lot, which was great. But that wasn't the primary objective. I wanted to make a lot of money. And I learned that it was not something that I was really passionate about, even though I gave it my all. I did really good work. And I am very grateful for the opportunity that I had there because I wouldn't be where I am today if I didn't have that opportunity. But I would say if I could go back in time to be less focused on the short-term gain and think about long-term career-wise, like what do you want to be doing every day and what makes you happy? Because you can be successful in any industry if you're passionate about it, and you don't necessarily need to pick an industry where you think you're going to make a lot of money. Because if you're passionate about something, you'll be successful. You can make it. It's all about the amount of drive and hard work that you put into something. Mm. So that'd be my advice.
I think that's brilliant, because there's so many people. I've mentioned these statistics before. I think 80% of Americans are unhappy at work, 12% are unsatisfied, and 8% are fulfilled. That's a huge portion of the population doing something that they hate, whether it's, even if it's lucrative, you can still be successful at what you do. And I'd venture that there's probably a lot of people in investment banking who don't necessarily like what they do, but they're there because
money.
And, that's a, it can be a great motivator, but it can also be very unfulfilling and very empty. But I mean, again, when you start floating 7-figure paychecks annually around people, you wind up falling into that trap. And that's a very hard trap to get out of and walk away from, I think, and pivot at some point in life, especially once you have a family and then you're accustomed to
the
apartment and the nice clothes and cars. And
then it becomes harder and harder to switch industries and also to take that gamble. You know, if I would have stayed in that industry for 5 more years or 10 more years, I probably wouldn't be doing what I'm doing today either, because at some point the risk becomes too great.
Yeah, the wife, once you have a wife, potentially kids, now you're, what if I can't put food on the table?
Exactly.
You know? And then there's all those things, man. Yeah. So I want to be completely respectful of your time. I know you guys are busy and you have a lot of things to attend to. But before that, I just want to commend you. I want to thank you for coming in. It's been a pleasure getting to know you over the past couple of years. I love what you and your brother do. And I think it's great. I love the entrepreneurial spirit. I love the fact that you guys did not give yourselves an out in your business and you stuck your minds to it. You pivoted along the way, but you built something that's going to be around for a long time, that's profitable. And I think for people listening, you dropped a lot of wisdom that they can pull from and gain knowledge from. And I think that's awesome. So I just want to thank you for sharing your story and thank you for being awesome, man.
Well, thanks for having me, man. I really appreciate it.
I appreciate it. And if you would just tell everybody where they can find you and where they can find your products.
Sure. So for Label, our website is label.co. Mm-hmm. And for Alteration Specialists, the website is alterationspecialists.com. You can also find us on Instagram. Our tag on Instagram is Alteration Specialists.
Cool.
And then for Label, it is at Wear Label.
Cool.
WEARLABEL.
Cool. And I will drop that in the show notes. Thanks again, David. I appreciate it, bro.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. Hey, everybody. Doing this has been an absolute journey and an amazing time. I have learned so much, and I want to thank you all for listening in. If you kindly would, we would just ask you for your support. If you've liked the show, if you've gained anything from it, please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes or any of the other platforms where you are viewing this. We would greatly appreciate it, and it means the world. Thank you so much for listening in. You can find us online at AnthonyVasquezWorkshops.com, as well as on social, on Instagram, Facebook, and on YouTube at Anthony Vasquez Workshops. We look forward to seeing you there.